Hey everyone, it's a busy week in the world of politics and climate. In the US, it's crunch time for the infrastructure bill, and we should know by the weekend what of it will make it through and become law. And on Sunday, the 31st of October, the COP26 climate negotiations in Glasgow officially kick off, where representatives from nations across the world will gather to take stock of where we're at with regard to the 2015 Paris Agreement and attempt to map a path forward. Now, the tie that binds, well, there's a lot of clean energy and climate-related legislation in the US infrastructure bill. Whether and what passes this weekend will impact the position from which the U.S. can approach the global climate negotiations, as a leader or, well, not. From BNF, we've got Ethan Zindler, head of Americas, and Vicky Cumming, head of global policy, on the show to tell us about what's going on, what to watch for, and their predictions of what they think will happen. This episode is based on our ongoing coverage of U.S. and global policy. BNF users can find this content on BNF.com, BNF Mobile, and, of course, on the terminal. And for everyone listening, we'll also be doing a public blog these next 2 weeks that will follow along with the COP26 proceedings and provide commentary. You can find it at bloomberg.com/professional/blog. As always, BNF does not provide investment or strategy advice, and you guessed it, the full disclaimer at the end of the show. I'm Mark Taylor, here with Dana Perkins, and you're listening to Switched On, the BNF podcast. Ethan, Vicky, welcome.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Okay, so we're going to kind of do this in two parts today, talk about the U.S. infrastructure bills, what's going on there, and then tie that into what's going on in COP26. But let's start off really basic, as we always do, and just talk about the infrastructure bills. So, Ethan, you and I were talking before, and I said generally, you know, the infrastructure bill, and you said, actually, it's a bit more complex than just that. I think out in the wide world, we call it that, but I think there's a bit more to it. Can you explain kind of the differences you were mentioning a bit ago?
Yeah, so there are two major pieces of legislation before Congress right now, neither of which have gotten final passage. One is the infrastructure bill that passed the Senate, but has not passed the House. The other is a so-called reconciliation bill, and that one has not passed either chamber so far. And basically, if you put the two together, you're talking about several trillion dollars potentially worth of support for U.S. infrastructure in the most literal sense, roads and bridges and clean energy, but also a lot of social programs that are potentially in both bills.
Which one has the things that BNF would write most about?
Actually, both. Both have a lot. The infrastructure bill that passed the Senate has some real support for electric vehicles and charging. But the reconciliation bill, the larger and arguably a good deal more controversial one, has long-term extensions for tax credits for wind and solar included. It has tax credits for electric vehicles included. It also has a potential, something akin to a national clean energy standard included in it. But all of that was what was in the original legislation a couple months ago, written by the House. It is being whittled down as we speak, and a slimmer version of that bill is ultimately what will get passed, if it gets passed.
Oh, man. Okay. Slimmer version, if it gets passed. Before we get into the mechanics of, you know, whether or not it'll pass, all that stuff, can you just describe to us just maybe a couple of the programs that you're excited about or interested in either of one of these?
The legislation contains a lot of things, but most importantly, I would argue for the wind and solar sector, it contains long-term 10-year extensions of tax credits. And those tax credits have historically really been the most important subsidy in the United States to support growth of clean energy. So that's probably number one on the list. Number two on the list is a national clean energy program that is aimed at essentially being a national renewable energy standard. That part of the bill almost certainly looks like it's not going to make the final cut at this point. The bill also has support for carbon capture and storage technology in the form of tax credits, for electric vehicles in the form of tax credits. It's got a lot of different goodies for a lot of different subsectors within the clean energy world.
You mentioned that it's now slimmer. And I think my question before you get into any more specifics on that is slimmer a bad thing? Because when I hear slimmer, I hear the opposite of throwing in irrelevant things, you know, which sometimes do get thrown into bills, which maybe are just kind of making their way along as part of the bartering process in order to get something passed. But something that's slimmer, in theory, could be a starting point, maybe not the final end game, but a starting point for a bigger conversation. Is that the case, or is a slimmer version something that really kills any hope for anything that is wider and maybe, as we discussed COP26, more internationally relevant?
When I say slimmer, primarily what I'm talking about is reducing some of the social program benefits that were in the original bill, but also, most importantly, as far as the clean energy sector is concerned, scrapping this potential national clean energy standard program. There's been plenty of debate, I would say, within the U.S. clean energy policy community about whether that's a big deal. My personal view is it's not as big a deal as people are making it out to be, given that the tax credits have always historically been what have boosted build of renewables. So, you know, that's probably what the slimming means as far as clean energy is concerned.
So it sounds like the slimming is kind of keeping the carrot, getting rid of the stick. But they also sound like really familiar kind of old tunes. We've heard of the tax credit before for the wind and solar. We've heard of the carbon capture and storage tax credit as well. What is that? 45Q, right? We've heard of tax incentives for buying electric vehicles. I guess my interest is there anything for, say, EV charging, electric vehicle charging? I saw an announcement this morning from, what was it, Hertz, that said they're going to buy 100,000 Teslas. Like, it sounds to me like an EV charging infrastructure could help things like that and others. Is there any new programs in there?
Yes, there is actually. There's a tax credit potentially for electric vehicle charging infrastructure. I actually believe that's in the infrastructure bill, the one that passed the Senate already. There is a so-called manufacturer's tax credit. It would give you basically a 30% CapEx discount on building a new manufacturing facility. And this is explicitly and specifically aimed at trying to grow the U.S. supply chain for strategic things like batteries and battery materials and other things like that.
Sounds timely.
Yeah, up and down the value chain, down to consumers, but also up to manufacturing and production. There's a lot of important stuff in the bill. One other note I would just say about, you know, you hear me saying tax credit. Tax credits have become essentially by default the system by which we support all kinds of things in the U.S., all kinds of social programs, everything. And tax credits, I mean, to be clear, as a policy mechanism, are terrible. They are inexact. They can be complicated to take advantage of. You don't really know how much you're going to get out of them unless you put some kind of cap on them. And the only one that's ever been capped has been around electric vehicles, at least within the clean energy sector. So they're very inexact, and it's very hard to know when they're not exactly needed. And this is why policy people really like things like clean energy standards, and they really like carbon prices and carbon markets. The reality of it is tax credits politically have worked in the U.S. in the past. They look like politically they might work again this time. And so that's probably what we're going to end up with.
I was going to say tax credits sound very American.
Well, yeah, I was going to say that I think it's one of the few places in the world where tax credits have played a big role in the clean energy deployment. In the rest of the world, it's been historically more of a story of feed-in tariffs and auctions, at least for renewables.
Last thing I'll say on tax credits is they suck as a policy mechanism.
Which may be why they are only used in the US.
They're just dumb, but they are our dumb thing, and they are what we're used to over here. They have the potential, let's be clear, to potentially over-subsidize things because they're not calibrated in any kind of way. But they work, and they are a lot simpler, frankly, than a national clean energy program, which is what's being proposed, you know, to come along with this. And if you had to pick one or the other, I think most people in the industry would say we will take a, you know, long-term extension of the tax credits over a new bureaucracy that mandates certain amounts of clean energy consumption.
Yeah, I mean, Vicky, what's your opinion on the flip side of that? So Ethan's not a big fan of tax credits. Is it working that much better in the rest of the world?
Well, in short, I would say yes.
Okay.
I would certainly say that renewables auctions have proved particularly successful at deploying large volumes of, say, wind and solar at costs that kind of more accurately reflect the underlying technology costs. So we've seen auction tariffs have tended to go downwards, but they don't always. For example, if there's like a delay on permitting or some kind of really heavy local content requirements, then they might not necessarily go down. but certainly they do help the government also kind of keep a tighter rein on their outlay in terms of expenditure as well, certainly compared with feed-in tariffs.
I was just going to say that the tax credits are an ugly beast, but they are our beast. And they're the beast that everybody knows. And that's why ultimately they seem to be politically possible. And the last thing, without getting too much into the politics, is that the reason why I think, and we'll see how this plays out, but I think that they'll get through is because the most important person in all these discussions, Senator Joe Manchin, who represents the state of West Virginia, seems to be open to policies that support renewable energy, that's tax credits, but opposed to policies that presumably would, you know, explicitly limit the role that coal and fossil fuels play. Never mind the sort of inconsistent thinking around that logic, but policies that appear to be, you know, specifically hurting fossils, he doesn't like, but policies that go to support renewables specifically, he's been open to, and I think that's why this will probably make it through.
Can you explain to everybody listening who is not a U.S. policy buff why Joe Manchin is significant and what he represents in this discussion?
So people have jokingly referred to him as Prime Minister Manchin or Co-President Manchin. The issue is that the Democrats have 50 elected members of the United States Senate, and the only reason effectively they have a so-called majority is because they can cast the 51st vote with the sitting Vice President Kamala Harris. That means that every single Democrat must vote for any piece of legislation to get through the Senate. And Joe Manchin is pretty much the most conservative member of the Democratic caucus, along with one other senator, Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona, but he's probably slightly more high profile. But the bottom line is you actually need to get all 50 senators on board. It's just that he's been the most challenging, because a big chunk of the rest of the caucus is considerably to the left of him.
Can I ask, this might be a dumb question, but apart from not wanting any Democratic legislation through, what do Republicans oppose in these bills? Is there anything policy-oriented that they actually oppose, or is it strictly political? Like, because you have Joe Manchin, you have Sinema, but you have 50 other people that could vote for this.
It's a great question. I mean, the first thing to note is, in fairness to Republicans, the infrastructure bill, which is the first bill, passed, I think, with 69 votes through the Senate. Like, a lot of Republicans got on board to support that. It had bipartisan support. That bill is pretty narrowly focused on roads, bridges. It has some EV support, but it's kind of a pretty conventional infrastructure bill. Republicans make the argument that the other bill goes way beyond the bounds of what the definition of infrastructure should be, to focus on social policy. They also seem to have found religion on the question of caring about the deficit and debt. And
again, huh?
Yeah, I say that ironically or sarcastically, because it does seem like whichever party controls the reins is usually typically willing to spend a lot of money, and deficits have run up big time under Republican presidents and Republican Congresses in the past. So I think, you know, now suddenly they're finding a certain amount, trying to find some fiscal discipline, and that's the argument that's being made to oppose this bill as well.
Can you discuss the longevity of these bills? Because I think as we get into this conversation around COP26, and we're looking ahead not just to 2030, but to 2050, that magical year that we're all kind of very much looking forward to when we're making policy decisions, a lot of discussion around the U.S. over the last few years has been around executive orders and how easy they are to rip out. So now we're at a place where there are things going through the Senate, going through the House. How long will these bills, in theory, be applicable?
That's a really good question. So there's the term of the bills, you know, in terms of the length of the legislation that have different programs. Many of the key programs are looking at a 10-year horizon in terms of how long they would be on the books. So that's what the legislation says. But as you rightly point out, there's the politics here. So the reality of it is that if the Democrats lose one or both chambers of Congress in 2022, by 2023, a Republican Congress could try to undo this through other legislative action. The good news, I guess, for those who support this bill is that Biden will still be president through the end of 2024 into the very start of 2025. So basically, you would not be able to undo anything that this Congress passes any earlier then 2025. And even in that circumstance, you would have to have basically a Republican president and probably Republican control of the House and the Senate. But all of this speaks to why Democrats are so anxious to getting something done now, because this really may be the last chance to try and pass something like this. The elections next year do not look good for Democrats at the moment. We got a full moon now, basically, a Democratic president, two chambers of Congress controlled by Democrats, and they feel like this is the moment that they've got to move. And I would agree with that, because I think you don't know what's going to happen in the future. And especially as we think about climate, there really is no time to waste when it comes to dealing with these issues.
Okay, so let's talk about what we think is going to happen here. There's a deadline on all of this, right? It's coming up.
Yeah, the end of the month, October 31st, has been set as the informal deadline by the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, when she says that she will bring both bills up for a vote on the floor of the House. That also not coincidentally happens to be really the eve of when the COP climate talks kick off in Glasgow. I may be off by a day, Vicky can correct me, but that's basically exactly that moment.
Yeah, the official opening ceremony, yeah, is the 31st of October.
I mean, with the time difference, it might even be pretty, like, you're within minutes.
So it's not coincidental. And, you know, the administration, I think, the Biden administration is keenly aware of that. Privately, last week, Biden said to a bunch of members of Congress, basically said, look, if you don't pass this bill, I'm showing up to Glasgow, you know, pretty empty handed. That's what he said privately. Then publicly, the White House was like, no. We've actually all got all this other great stuff that we've done. We've written these regulations and whatever. But like that is, as I've said to Vicky in the past, that's like putting lipstick on a pig. They've done some great stuff. There's no question about that on writing regulations. But you cannot show up at COP and honestly say that the U.S. has on its books any kind of long-term commitment to really address these issues unless Congress passes something. So the pressure is really there. Now, will they do something by the end of this week? I think so. But gosh, it's really, really hard to predict. Over the weekend, Nancy Pelosi said basically, oh, yeah, we've almost got a deal. And then this morning, it doesn't look so great. To me, the person that I think is most perplexing and worrisome to everybody is Senator Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona, who, while Manchin has been out there, and I think we kind of know what it is he wants and doesn't like, she's total enigma to most people at this point. She seems to like clean energy tax credits. That's what the reporting has been. But she also really seems to like to be a gadfly. And I have this fear that she's going to blow the whole thing up at the end of the day. But all things being even, I think they will get something done by the end of this week. And one last factor, which people don't talk about, is Halloween is on October 31st. And I'm telling you, that is like a sacred holiday here in the United States. That's when every kid goes out and goes trick-or-treating. The Washington Bureau of Bloomberg by like 3:30 p.m. is usually pretty quiet. All the parents have run home to like get the kids set up. No parent in Congress is going to want to be fiddling with this on October 31st. I think that is the sort of, that's the sleeper pressure here to get this done.
Well, it's also a Sunday, Ethan.
Yep.
So even more, you know, incentive. So full moon, Halloween.
Ooh.
Yeah.
COP.
It's
exactly.
all coming together. COP, it's all coming together. Wait, so hang on. The infrastructure bill has already passed the Senate and the House, right? And the House?
No, it has not passed the House.
No, okay.
Just the Senate.
Okay, so we're likely to get at least one of two. Is that right?
No. I mean, that's the issue here, is that basically the votes are there to pass the infrastructure bill, basically more or less on its own. But liberals in the House are saying, hey, wait a second, we're not voting for this bill unless we get to also vote on this reconciliation bill. And we also get to actually pass it. They're saying, we're not in on your infrastructure bill unless you're in on this reconciliation bill. And they make the argument that if you don't do both at once, that you'll never come back on the issues that are raised in the reconciliation bill. And I think they raise a fair point, because I think Joe Manchin doesn't necessarily really want to come back on any of that stuff. He's pushing to just pass the infrastructure bill on its own and be done with it. But liberals are saying, we're not coming along unless you give us something in return, which is the reconciliation bill.
Ethan, a quick walk down memory lane before we segue over to COP. One of my earliest memories in NEF, when we were a startup before we were part of Bloomberg, was sitting in our office where Ethan, Nat Bullard, and I shared an office. And we shared a YouTube video in 2009 of Joe Manchin shooting the cap and trade bill with a gun, signifying his stance on the whole issue. Do you remember that?
I do remember he ran for re-election by making an advertisement in which he took the Waxman Markey bill, pinned it to a tree, and shot it with a rifle. Yeah. And it worked. He got re-elected. Manchin knows his constituency. I mean, it's a conservative part of the country. And the history and the heritage of West Virginia is coal mining. And it's one of the poorer states in the country. And coal mining has been hit badly in the U.S. But, you know, I still don't think that necessarily justifies his position. But let's remember, these members of Congress represent individual parts of the United States. And this is why he is who he is in terms of his positions on things.
Okay, so this weekend, it all kind of comes down to it. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the impacts of the U.S. giving the yay or nay and what it means for the climate talks in Glasgow. Stay with us. Okay, welcome back. We're going to change gears just a little bit and talk about the global stage. Upcoming, starting on October 31st and running to what, November 14th, is the COP26 negotiations in Glasgow, Scotland. So for the uninitiated, I'm sure you've heard about it on the news, but Vicky, can you start us off and just tell us what this is? What are these negotiations?
COP stands for Conference of the Parties to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. So all of the governments that signed up to this UN FCCC will come to Glasgow to discuss how best to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and adapt to climate change. And it's usually an annual affair, but this is actually, we had a gap because of COVID-19 last year. So it's actually been 2 years since the last one. And this year it's hosted by the UK.
And there seems to be a lot of pressure on this one. Is it that because of the two-year hiatus, or is there something special about this one?
Certainly kind of it's been heightened expectations, I think, because we've had this two-year break. But it's also important because it's the first occasion where, the first like official occasion when countries can discuss their climate plans out to 2030. So those are called nationally determined contributions, or NDCs. And it marks the start of this process whereby, first of all, governments say what they're willing to do and how they plan to adapt to climate change. Then in 3 years' time, we have what's called the global stocktake. So it's essentially an assessment where you take all of those plans together and see what the impact would be in terms of mitigating climate change. With then the view is that the next step is that governments then go away and revise their plans and in theory, increase the ambition of their targets and pledges.
I mean, I think it's safe to say that among these COP meetings, which now we're on the 26th one, certain ones really stand out. So this is a continuation of Paris. And if you rewind the clock really far, Kyoto is another one that really stands out as a meeting where there was, you know, reasonable amount of crystallization, let's say, of thought. There are others that also stand out for other reasons is not doing that. So Copenhagen, I think, is the one that many of us think of where we say, well, that meeting maybe didn't quite do what we set out to do. Now, Vicky, one of the things you've done as a preparation for this meeting is to have a think as to whether or not you think this will be one of those meetings where we continue to say Glasgow for years to come in a positive light or maybe slightly lackluster light. So there are some probabilities that you associated with this outcome. Now, should we lead with the headline? Should we lead with what you think the overall probability is? Or do you want to break down the different areas that perhaps you looked at when trying to decide if this is going to be a success or relative failure?
Well, maybe we'll take the pyramid principle and start with, so the flagship, like our overall expectation, and then we'll explain what we actually mean by that, is that there's, say, a 47% chance that COP26 will be a success. And by success in this case, because there's lots of different definitions of that, means that it makes meaningful progress towards actually achieving the goals of the Paris Agreement. So, as I'm sure you recall, the Paris Agreement agreed to limit global warming to 2 degrees and to try to make that limit to 1.5 degrees. And the way that we've came to this 47% is that we broke it down into, okay, so where do we actually expect countries to make progress? What are the sort of 15 metrics? For example, do we expect all of these NDC targets, so these 2030 emission targets, to collectively put the planet on a path to 1.5 degrees? Do we expect parties to make some kind of pledge about coal power? Do we expect developed countries to meet the target to pledge $100 billion per year in climate finance? And we looked at what we thought the probabilities for each of those 15 metrics and then totted them all up. And that's how we came to our overall estimate.
I got a definitional question for you. And as we get into the discussion around what they're actually going to discuss at the event, there's a lot of conversation around carbon emissions and then also discussions around methane, which I think hasn't gotten quite the same amount of play. But let's start on the carbon emissions side of things. Can you explain what net zero means? Because it's important to differentiate that net zero is different than absolute zero. And as countries are creating commitments, or at least talking about potentially maybe someday making commitments towards net zero, can you give us a definition there?
Sure. And maybe first of all, just to explain where that net zero number comes from. So the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change produced a special report in 2018 that looked at where emissions need to be in order to achieve these 1.5 or 2 degrees targets. And they said that in order to get to ensure that global warming doesn't exceed 1.5 degrees by the end of the century, by the middle of the century, i.e. 2050, then the world needs to be at net zero emissions. And that means that for greenhouse gas emissions, so not just carbon, not just methane, all of them. And it means it takes into account, it doesn't mean that all countries then need to have no emissions. It takes into account what we call carbon sinks. So these are things like forests or land that are able to absorb or sequester and then store carbon or emissions. Does that explain?
Yes, I think it does. So there's a emissions out versus emissions that are able to be absorbed, at least on the carbon side of things. And just to talk a little bit about that those IPCC scenarios, of the five scenarios they've come up with, only one of them actually results with us meeting a 1.5 degree scenario. All of the other four are above. So this is definitely something that we need to be critically thinking about regarding tipping points. Now, does this apply regarding this concept of net zero? Does this apply to methane, or is there a different dialogue around methane emissions?
Methane emissions, the topic of that has really kind of suddenly emerged, I'd say, in the last few months, where previously everybody was focusing on greenhouse gas emissions or on carbon. They then have been looking at what they can do to tackle methane emissions. And most recently, there's the European Union and the US and various other countries have made this what they've called a global methane pledge, which is to cut global methane emissions by at least 30% from 2020 levels by 2030. And at the moment, by our analysis, about a quarter of the world's methane emissions are covered by that pledge. So if they really want to achieve that target, they'll need a big methane emitter like China and Russia and India to really sign on.
Well, I mean, I think the main thing on methane to point out, or methane as the case may be, is that it stays in the atmosphere for only 10 years, whereas CO2 stays in 100 years, but it's 80 times more potent. So that's why it's become a bigger conversation in recent years.
It's also become a bigger conversation because the US has chosen it as a topic and it's one where they can make progress. So it makes them look better.
I would also argue it's one where progress can probably be achieved more easily than on CO2. I mean, you can plug wells. It does financially make more sense for companies not to be flaring and wasting extra gas up into the atmosphere. This is a problem that is arguably much more solvable than the CO2 problem.
But it's also a much smaller problem.
True. But as you know, this is all going to be about making some headlines, right? So methane or methane, however you want to say it, feels like it's one that I suspect we'll probably see some positive news out of and a fair amount of sort of victory lapping on out of COP. But Vicky, you know better than I do.
Speaking of headlines, though, let's pivot slightly towards what to watch for. So Vicky mentioned the 47%. Dana, you mentioned the probabilities of success in each of the key areas. But if I'm listening on the radio. I mean, I even heard the COP26 mentioned on the BBC this morning. If I'm listening on the radio and they mention something coming out of Glasgow or not, what should I be listening for? Is a pledge on methane good? enough, or is there something else that I should listen for to know if this thing's been a success?
I think in some respects, it's the very fact that they're having a COP is important to note. So one of the main benefits of this process is that it brings governments together, whether virtually or in person, where they can kind of eye each other up to see what have you committed to and what have you actually achieved. So the Paris Agreement, it doesn't impose binding emission targets or any targets on the signatories. It's really this kind of system of peer pressure of who wants to be the climate leader and who wants to keep up with their peers. And that's really important. I think we would be looking for concrete commitments in terms of finance. So I mentioned earlier the $100 billion a year target. It's very, very small fry in terms of the actual amounts of finance, but it was committed to by developed countries to provide this financing by 2020 for developing countries. So it's really important to the kind of political process, the diplomatic process, and building trust between the developed and developing countries, and to persuade developing countries to take on much more ambitious climate targets, which will be necessary if we want to achieve the goals of the Paris Agreement.
I would just add that $100 billion in the grand scheme of things, the other way to look at it is it's a really small price to pay to get developing countries to feel that there is a follow-through taking place. And to be clear, some number of their pledges are directly contingent on getting support from wealthier countries. They literally say, we're not following through unless we get this help. So symbolically, it's really important, but literally, it's really important. And it's in the grand scheme of things, as Vicky points out, it's really not that much money, given the size of the amount of money that needs to go into the sector to solve the problem.
Are there countries not showing up that are part of these contingencies?
It depends. If we mean the physically showing up, there have certainly been headlines recently about, say, China's Xi and Russia's Putin are reportedly not coming. But I don't think they should be taken, those kind of announcements should be taken with a pinch of salt, really. It's not immediately linked between whether the political leader is present in Glasgow with how much the country is willing to commit to. So actually, Xi hasn't left China since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. They take a really conservative approach to travel. And yet we've still seen since then that actually China's committed to carbon neutrality and is making progress on some of the more concrete policies, even though it's true, it's like headline 2030 emissions target is really not that ambitious.
I would just completely editorialize here and say that it does seem like she likes to upstage Biden whenever he gets the chance. And also, so I suspect there'll be a quote-unquote surprise out of China. Who knows what it'll be? Maybe it's that he shows up. Maybe they make some announcement on domestic coal, which to my mind is one of the biggest outstanding issues. China has a huge coal fleet. They made a pledge to stop financing overseas coal, and that was very well received, I think, generally. But it did not address the fact that they have this massive coal fleet. And they, by the way, have another couple hundred gigawatts of coal-fired power plants that they have under development there over the next, you know, 5-10 years. So some announcement around that, I think, would make headlines, and justifiably so if they did it.
Yes, that would be absolutely enormous, because China accounts for a huge chunk of actually what's planned for coal power. And it would also put pressure on India and Indonesia and other countries in the region to follow suit.
It would effectively spell the very end of any further coal project development in the world if they did that. We're almost there outside of China and India, basically, because nobody's funding coal other places, including China. But inside their borders is a different story right now.
So this all sounds to me like we're going to need to do a post game. How about we have you guys back to get into what happened in the US and in COP in a couple of weeks. And we'll dig into some of the details as well. We didn't get to a lot of things, whether there's going to be a global carbon price, what the chances are there. We could talk about what happened. So free to come back in a couple of weeks?
Yeah, but hey, can I, absolutely, before we go, can I plug some other cool stuff? First of all, Vicky's note is fantastic, which we're just about to, it's Monday, this will be out, which will be out by the time this podcast goes, so definitely BNF clients, check that out. And then the second thing is that we're going to attempt to blog through the entire COP and write something hopefully every day, but probably at least every other day. And please keep an eye out for that, because Vicky's got a lot of great more stuff to say. And we'll get input from our colleagues in the Asia Pacific region, where so much of the important potential commitments could come from out of COP.
So where should people go to find this blog?
Bloomberg.com.
Okay. Ethan, Vicky, thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Today's episode of Switched On was edited by Rex Warner of Greystoke Media. Bloomberg NEF is a service provided by Bloomberg Finance LP and its affiliates. This recording does not constitute, nor should it be construed as, investment advice, investment recommendations, or a recommendation as to an investment or other strategy. Bloomberg NEF should not be considered as information sufficient upon which to base an investment decision. Neither Bloomberg Finance LP nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. We'll be right back.